Shrink Wrap Radio number 728, The Tao of Bodybuilding and Trauma Psychotherapy, with Chaz Frank, LCSW.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Chaz Frank, MSW, LCSW, who has a Master's of Social Work degree from St. Louis University. Chaz has been a practicing LCSW since 2009 with expertise in forensic psychology, trauma, sexual trauma, and more. He's presented on such topics as wisdom and self-compassion, mindfulness, self-care, transference, and counter-transference. Our sponsor for today's show is BetterHelp.com, the planet's premier online therapy service. Now, here's the interview. Chaz Frankie, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio. You'd think I could say it by now.
No, that's our man. I'm so glad to be here, though. I'm excited to talk to you. This is, this is like a fanboy opportunity for me.
I'm equally excited. I have discovered that you're a fanboy. As I was going through my email to set this up, I saw that you had sent me some email 5 years ago, not requesting anything, but just letting me know that you're a big fan. So it's nice that the time has come around for you to be on the mic.
Yeah, I'm thrilled. What it was years ago, even I was always recommending my students at SLU to listen to certain episodes and to check certain things out. And so there was always kind of a running dialogue of the episodes in house. And I thought, well, I got to tell you about it. You deserve to know the important work you're doing out here.
Yeah. That's so reinforcing when I do get news of that, because, you know, I'm just talking. Some of the time it feels like I'm talking to myself, you know, and I need to know that there are people out there. In fact, you shared with me that you go all the way back to my Wise Counsel podcast, which is quite a ways back.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can think going back to those interviews and those were some of the biggest names. I mean, I've always been a real therapy nerd that studied from the beginning. And the best thing that Shrink Wrap's always contributed, and Wise Counsel before that for me, was like a historical perspective of the work that I was doing. And I think that you've cataloged kind of like the history of therapy in your own path. And so when I think of just the books that I've read just from the podcast, from Gary Trosclair and Working on It in Therapy, and Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, and War of the Gods of Addiction. And I mean, I could just tell you probably 50 books I've read just because you've talked to the authors.
Yeah. Wow. That's really good. And I've discovered that you've had such a varied and fascinating career. And that's one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you. And not just in terms of psychotherapy, but also in bodybuilding and spiritual practices. But first, let's get started with your background. Where did you grow up?
So I'm from Southern Illinois. I'm about 15 minutes outside of downtown St. Louis.
Okay.
So right on the Illinois-Missouri border, and I've been here most of my life.
Uh-huh. And what were your young years like? I mean, you've turned into such an interesting person. I want to know how that happened.
Well, I appreciate that. I came up in a Catholic school, Catholic education, played hockey most of my life, and had kind of the, a bit of the probably rough and tumble background, in terms of just making my way that a lot of therapists have, you know, maybe a bit of the wounded healer talk of, you know, just not everything was pretty and not everything went as planned. And before long, I was somebody that wanted to help people out, you know, that wanted to maybe listen and pay attention to people that weren't always listened to and paid attention to.
Did you grow up in a rough area?
No, I mean, I just kind of grew up with some, you know, had some rough aspects of childhood and, you know, low-key traumatic aspects of childhood. And also what I would attribute to kind of move into some of the lifting stuff, I grew up real overweight. I was a real big kid, a real heavy kid. And, you know, obesity is just not pretty when you're 8, 9, 10, 13, 14, 15 years old. So I really, you know, had a lot of bullying and stuff in my background there, too.
Well, I don't think anybody's going to bully you now. One of the things that really impressed me was you sent me a large photo of yourself. I always put a small photo. Mm-hmm. Your photo is so dramatic because you've got all these really colorful tattoos and you're a big guy. And I'm probably going to put a somewhat larger. I said, I ought to put this whole big photo on the show. I probably will put a larger one than my standard one, but I got interested in that. And so so the fact that you played hockey, that's a rough and tumble sport. You're talking ice hockey?
Yeah.
So you must have developed some of your athleticism and body confidence via hockey.
Yeah. I played hockey for a long time. I had a bunch of knee injuries. I had a knee injury at 16 and had a big surgery from that, and a knee injury at 19 and had a big surgery from that. And a lot of that just added to being heavier. You know, I was a big, even as a hockey player, I was a big kid and a heavy kid. And then right after my second surgery, I started lifting. I said, well, I got to get in better shape. You know, I was probably like over 340 some odd pounds and, you know, just couldn't really play at the same level. I was getting towards the end of skating in terms of like a high competitive. And by then I had found therapy, right? I was 18 going 19 into 20 and I was going to school. I knew I wanted to be a therapist. I feel very lucky. I decided really early on I wanted to do therapy.
Well, how did you discover it at 18, 19, 20? I don't even know if I knew the word.
I will admit, as a clinical social worker, I definitely didn't know what social work was when I was 18 or 19, and here I am. But I think the second part of that origin story in a lot of ways is that I was that person that a lot of people talk to and that I really valued. Like, man, I really value being trusted. And, you know, I was somebody that had been exposed, you know, at certain times in my life to just dishonesty and people that couldn't be open with what they were feeling or share what they were feeling. And I realized how much I valued hearing the things that people were worried they couldn't say anywhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that's part of my own history that kind of sent me in that trajectory, you know?
Yeah.
Which, as you suggest, probably a lot of people who are therapists, social workers, et cetera, have an early experience of being a confidant, somebody who cared and, you know, was interested and so on. Yeah, because I was wondering what came first, you know, becoming a therapist, bodybuilding, spiritual practices. So it sounds like bodybuilding was first.
Yeah, I was on the move. My bachelor's is in psychology, so I was starting to move towards psychology at that point, and started working out. Like, just the story is really like I started working out at like home. I'm doing 50 push-ups, 100 sit-ups, and riding 3 miles on a stationary bike. No matter how long it took, because I was out of shape. You know, yeah. Like, so 50 push-ups wasn't, let me just hang out 50. It was, if I can do one or two, I'm going to do 25 sets of two as long as I get to 50.
Yeah.
And trying to get in shape. And then around that time also was the first time that I was exposed to the Tao Te Ching, to the translations from Stephen Mitchell, who is just my favorite translator of the Tao. And that's when my Eastern interests, like, low-key started. I didn't really get into Buddhism until, like, 23, maybe 24 years old. But I was heavily reading Eastern spirituality by 20, probably.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating. And so it all happened more or less in a fairly tight timeline, it sounds like.
Yeah.
That I wonder what it is in you. Do you have any idea where this kind of inner strength comes from? Because, you know, the strength when you weigh 300 plus pounds to start doing push-ups when you can only do maybe one or two to start with, that's kind of a unique strength, I think. It's sure. kind of rare.
I appreciate that.
Was that modeled for you? Do you think you were just born with it?
You know, it's a good question. I appreciate you saying that too, because I know, I mean, I came from a world that valued the idea of being strong. I mean, like my dad, my grandpa were, they were milkmen. They delivered milk for, you know, like my grandpa was door to door, things like that. And I come from a background that valued just being strong and providing, you know, like being somebody that is willing to kind of do the work and have that discipline. And working out was my first opportunity, I think, to just own what I was doing. It wasn't a team sport. It wasn't a coach necessarily. Uh-huh. It was just like, this is my first opportunity that the rubber meets the road. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it my way and see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. It almost sounds like you had a sense of calling early. And I actually used Arnold Schwarzenegger's book in a class on, I think it was a class on myth, dream, and symbol.
Oh, my goodness.
And his first book was called what? Do you remember the title? It was an autobiographical book.
Yeah, I remember. I've read it, too.
Yeah. And I was, you know, and he's such a salesman. I think he probably, I just got caught up in the enthusiasm of his life. But the course was myth, dream, and symbol. And I thought, here is a guy who's really got the hero archetype that he's following, he's imbued with, and his story had a kind of mythic dimension. And so I thought it was worthy of being one of five books that I signed. And I'm sure my young students probably went, wow, who is this teacher?
I needed to be in that class. Boy, that's a good class.
It was a good class. I taught it for many years. And it was in New Hampshire, actually. I taught for 2 years in New Hampshire. And I was really valued by the students for bringing some non-traditional psychological ideas to my teaching. And when I spoke to you on email, I said I want to talk about your bodybuilding, and you kind of corrected that a little bit. You said, "Well, actually, I don't think of myself as a bodybuilder, but rather somebody who's involved in strength training." Mm-hmm. Yeah, say something about that. Educate me.
Yeah. So so my background competitively, I spent 15 years like competing, training, and coaching the sport of strongman, which is like, if you remember way back in the day, you know, ESPN or CBS would have World's Strongest Man. And they still do. They'd have contests where guys are picking up rocks, they're pulling trucks, they're loading kegs, they're doing weird deadlifts and stuff. That eventually evolved into a sport called strongman. And so I competed in that for years, just loading what are called Atlas stones, dirt and hand strength events, walking with weight on your back, some circus kinds of elements, you know, tearing decks of cards, tearing phone books, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And that was my main sport for a while. But that was where my general ability to be curious about myself physically was born, you know, where it's like I would take on you're always taking on a different challenge in a sport that is so varied.
Uh-huh.
Whereas like with bodybuilding, bodybuilding is very aesthetic, right? Like Schwarzenegger is a bodybuilder, right? He looks perfect. And he's in the gym for who knows how long at the peak of his life, doing high reps, doing every kind of movement. and looking very aesthetically perfect. Strongman doesn't necessarily look perfect physically. There's a lot of just big boys with big bellies that are, you know, solid as a rock, but, you know, they look different. And then the third one in kind of the category of a lot of strength training is powerlifting, which is people that just do squat, bench, and deadlift competitively. They total up their numbers.
And you told me that now you're working on open ocean swimming?
Yeah, I do a lot of open water swimming now. You know, kind of locally we have lakes and stuff like that. So I swim and then jumping into, you know, doing other stuff whenever I can get to a coast, whenever I can get to a Lake Tahoe or something like that to do a couple of miles at a time.
Yeah. Wow. I guess part of the reason I'm so odd is I think in high school I weighed 128 pounds. So I'm on the opposite.
That's my birth weight.
Of your birth weight. Great. And I'm just remembering what grabbed me in Schwarzenegger's book was there's a place where he said the first time he grabbed the bar to lift some weights, that it was like a transcendental experience for him, that he just had this over. And so I thought, wow, that just sounds so archetypal. Maybe he was lying. Maybe he was exaggerating. I don't know. But on the other hand, he did. He achieved all of his goals. There's a guy who, you know, he said, I want to become president, I think, of the U.S. Well, he wasn't able to do that, but he became governor of one of the biggest, most influential states in the Union politically. So quite a life that guy's had.
Yeah, unbelievable.
But I'm really interested to know, I mean, people are going to think, well, hey, is this whole conversation going to be about strength, you know, bodybuilding and strength training? Yes and no, because it also plays into yourself, into every facet of your being, I would say, in terms of your personality, your spirit, your profession. So we want to get into all of that stuff. And you sent me some articles that you had written, and I pulled out some of the dynamics that I was particularly interested in, and I want to march us through those, and you can go wherever you want with each one in terms of talking about spirituality, talking about therapy and your approach to therapy, talking about bodybuilding, whatever fits.
Sure.
So let's start talking about compassion. And you said that early on, kids would approach you, your peers, and that you felt some sort of, it sounds like you felt some compassion and being drawn to be there. So say more about compassion and how that comes into the various facets of your work and being.
I think that there's, over time, I mean, from an early point even to now, the one thing that hasn't changed is, like, I've always taken a fair amount of pride in being very patient. That I just don't, I don't really see the need for speed. I always, sometimes I quote Clifton Mitchell, who's a therapist in Tennessee, that says, never sacrifice direction for speed, right? Like, I've always liked the long game of something. And I feel like that's what compassion provides, right? Compassion provides the space for development, because it's, yes, there's a warm, gentle, passionate approach to anything if you're compassionate, if you can be understanding. And so when it comes to like therapy, you know, compassion seems like an obvious part, but part of my compassion in therapy is the gentleness of it. Is the patience of it. Like, yes, of course, your client is going to tell you that they've relapsed or that they're still in that relationship that they know they probably shouldn't be in. But my role is to be understanding of that process.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in the world of strength or physicality, it would be the same thing. Like, if you can be compassionate with yourself, let's say, then you can embrace the grind of, you know, adding 5 pounds to a lift in a year, which once you're super experienced, that's a big thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, but it takes the patience and compassion. It takes the idea of, like, how do I look at myself after a day of failures and still say, this is okay.
Yeah.
And then the approach to compassion.
From the bio that you sent me, I got the impression that you're fairly eclectic in your approach to therapy. You've drawn on a lot of influences, but it sounds like you're mostly guided by a psychodynamic understanding.
Yeah.
And I think that demands patience.
Yeah.
The long view, right? It's taking the long view. We're going to really work to understand you and your situation, and don't be in too big a hurry to make it all go away.
Yeah, that's what describes me to a T, is frustratingly slow, maybe, in that, like, oh, let's keep looking, you know? Eric Fromm wrote about that if nothing else, what Freud gave to the world was the idea that every human being's every single nuance was deserving of process.
Uh-huh.
That every thought, yeah, every association, every moment could be looked at and given like the real attention it deserves.
Yeah.
So even if you don't agree with old Freudian theory, he at least brought this idea of you know, curious time to it.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing that you've written about is curiosity. And where does that play? And feel free to throw in any case histories or stories that come to mind, either personal or professional.
With curiosity, so curiosity to me first came about on the heels of working with so much, because I was working with trauma, so I was working with so much like shame. And more than anything, I was working with so much self-criticism, you know, like that heavy baked into the equation self-criticism that somebody can have, where they can take any part of their life and detail to you that they've messed it up, that they're not good enough, that they don't do enough. And to me, that level of criticism was just kind of like the shadow of certain parts of curiosity, you know, because curiosity is saying, well, let's look at all kinds of different ideas. Let's look at every little piece of this and see what it is. Well, the self-critic is doing that. It's just very lopsided, you know, self-critic is coming in there and saying, you're too big, you're too little, you're too slow, you're too dumb, you're not good enough, people leave you. Right. But that's just the shadow of the idea of like, well, but what about like a million little options? Right. Like, what about the idea that you're going to be okay and this is really painful? Or what about the idea that you're working really hard at this and you're not doing that great yet? You know, my Buddhist teacher, sometimes whenever you say something, his name's Justin von Boydash. He's in Brooklyn. And if you say something like, but, you know, we'll get through it, he'll go, or maybe not.
Yeah.
You know, like it's keeping all of the different angles there. And so therapeutically, I love that idea of just like, well, what if we find some small kernel of something here that we can become endlessly fascinated in? And then the person sitting in the room with you, they get the opportunity to have somebody who's endlessly fascinated in them.
Right.
You know, and that's
a great privilege and a treat.
Oh, and it's amazing. And it's a great treat for me. Yeah. You know, I get to really ask these questions. And so curiosity became something where I knew as long as somebody can become curious about themselves, maybe the way a therapist is curious about them, asking questions that other people don't ask, taking an angle they hadn't thought to approach before, then curiosity becomes this major kind of curative balm, you know, like you kind of hear people say it's curative, but not curing, you know, it makes you feel more seen or heard, but it's not going to fix everything. It's constant. Okay. It's always available.
Let me jump in here to tell you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp.com. The world's premier online therapy service. Given the pandemic we're currently in, most of us could probably use some help with our emotions. Within 48 hours, BetterHelp can match you with a licensed professional therapist, regardless of where in the world you are. And they're committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, even making it easy and free to change counselors if needed. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions. Beyond that, financial aid is available. Visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted there daily. For example, here's one that was posted on December 11th by BetterHelp user CH. After counseling with Shoshana Root for 3 months on issues concerning addictions, relationships, family conflicts, intimacy-related issues, self-esteem, and coaching, CH writes, and I quote, "Shoshana is an incredible therapist. She's very open, and I never feel judged when speaking with her. She has a variety of techniques that she uses, as well as being very compassionate. I have always looked forward to my sessions with her and appreciate the support she gives me." Close quote. So visit betterhelp.com/shrink. That's betterhelp.com. Now here's the special offer for Shrink Wrap Radio listeners. You'll get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/shrink. Now back to the interview. Now, you've done a lot of forensic work, right, which to me has the association of somehow involved with the law. What were the forensic settings that you were working in?
I actually worked as a community worker in on a forensic unit. Now, I didn't work for the forensic unit. I actually worked for a provider that helped people transition off of a forensic unit. And so that was not guilty by reason of insanity and unfit to stand trial cases. My most individual work with the legal system in general was I worked in addiction for the Illinois Department of Corrections. And what that was really a sign of, in a lot of ways, was the way that trauma interacted with addiction. I mean, if you want to talk about the law enforcement world in general, there's so many overlaps with trauma, even with community tension and stuff like that. That's, you know, probably out of my range in some ways. But man, I mean, when I worked in a prison, everybody had so much trauma, you know, like you'd be running a group and they all had a bullet wound, you know. Yeah. It's like, I don't know your whole history, but man, if I had a bullet wound somewhere, it's all I would talk about. And these guys were just like, somebody would say, "Oh, my shoulder hurts because I got shot." And there'd be five other guys in the group that would say, "Oh yeah, I got shot in the shoulder and right here." And I, you know, and it's like, yeah. Oh man, you guys are wearing your trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically you were working with people who were criminals, who had criminal convictions. Mm-hmm. And, I would think that your size would be an advantage in that situation. Like people would, you know, not want to take you on or challenge you physically. And at the same time, they get to discover that, whoa, this guy's a gentle giant. Mm-hmm. That must have served you really well.
Yeah, it's something where, I'm so glad you bring that up too, because it's something where I have always... It took me a very long time to really own how important it was for me to say out loud, like that I'm very gentle. I don't have aggressive pieces of me. I don't have anything other than like that kind of like softness in terms of how I view people. And that was something that I had to put a lot of focus in terms of my willingness to accept that part of myself, not to go all like Richard Schwartz internal family systems, but like that part that like maybe exiled gentle side.
Uh-huh.
And the working amongst like real tough guys and these big inmates and stuff that were, a lot of them were one-on-one just as capable of being gentle as I was. It's not like they were all just coming at you or aggressive, but it was definitely an advantage to just be like, yeah, I'm a big dude in the front of the room. And all I want to do is talk about your feelings, man. Like, that's it all day, tireless.
Another thing on that I took note of was creativity, which is something that you've written about.
Yeah. I have viewed over time, like, creativity is something that everybody has a form of.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much a form that they're looking for, but they're doing it, right? Like, you know, your work with 728 episodes of Shrink Wrap Radio and like whatever, 100 episodes of Wise Counsel. And like, this is immensely creative,
Thank you.
And before that you were a therapist, which was, and a professor, which is immensely creative. And my therapy to me is my creative outlet. Like, it's an opportunity for me to be like, oh man, like, I'm going to create something brand new every hour.
Wow.
I'm going to have
a great attitude. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to have a conversation I've never had before. You know, there's certain guys before, like, I know Artie Lang, that was an analyst, spoke similarly about, like, you meet a new person every time you talk. And so it's got to be creative, because no matter how much I may want as a therapist to be like, okay, last week we talked about this, which means we can move into this, which means we can do some more cognitive work here and some mindfulness here. That could go out the window the second somebody comes down and says, hey, my husband left. I don't know what I'm going to do. And it's like, okay, time to get creative. And that creativity is in its own way this circle back to compassion. Because if somebody finds new ways to create from what wasn't there, they have to be willing to discard certain things. And the more that you're willing to say, this isn't working, or I don't have to do it this way, is the more compassionate you can be with yourself. And that feeds your creativity.
I would think your creativity also is the fact that you are aware of and like to keep yourself on the creative edge is good against burnout.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's and if you look at like some of the warning signs of burnout and compassion fatigue, it's usually things like oversimplifying or minimizing are these big signs, like warning signs. You know, like Laura Vandernoot Lipsky has 16 warning signs in trauma stewardship that are great. And like minimizing is one, where if you sit with somebody and you're like, man, I gotta a person getting divorced at 1 o'clock. I got a person whose grandma died at 2 o'clock. I got a person who just got another DUI and his wife's leaving at 3 o'clock, you know, just another day. Like, as soon as you're doing that, that means you're exhausted, right? Like, I mean, because all of those are not only painful and overwhelming, but they're deep and they're heavy and they're very process lending kinds of things. Like, we can get into it, but if I minimize any of them, or if I think, oh, well, you know, I've been dealing with people getting divorced for 15 years. What are you going to do? I'm tired.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean I'm a bad clinician. It means I'm a tired clinician.
Uh-huh.
So I have to have that creativity rolling all the time.
Well, I think that your involvement in your physical stuff, your strength training certainly also helps you, you know, it's a way to bleed off a lot of that energy, I would think,
For sure.
To keep yourself vital.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got a lot of balance in your life, I think, because you're working hard on your physical vitality and you're working hard on your spiritual quest and that leaves you available for your therapeutic work.
No, I feel very fortunate, and I think that this is where I've always liked a lot of parts therapies. So like internal family systems, even Jungian stuff with shadow work, transactional analysis, like a lot of parts therapies I've always really enjoyed, because the end game is integration.
Yeah,
you know, the end game is whether it be individuation, authentic self, capital S self, whatever it may be. It's always like integration. It's always like, how can all of these things flow together? And I feel very fortunate that I've been able to, in that way, practice a lot of what I preach, and that I've never separated things out. You know, when I was competing in strongman, I was still writing articles as a Buddhist competing in strongman, you know, like as a therapist, I am, you know, I have my symbolism and my statues all over the office, because it's just a big part of who I am. And I didn't want to keep who I am out of my therapeutic process. And so I definitely have felt fortunate to be able to enmesh these things in ways that I think have really been good for me, and hopefully good for the people that I'm in the service of.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure that you are. One of the things you've written about fits into what you were just saying. You talk about the sacred self. What's your sense of that?
To me, like, the process of pursuing like a sacred self is the idea of how you connect with yourself in these really safe, really meaningful ways. You know, I was very inspired in my career by early on by like Rollo May. Rollo May was a big inspiration for me. And I just devoured a lot of those books because there was that whole idea of not just a fulfilled life from an existential point of view, but an unapologetic self. And so the sacred self for me encapsulates these things that we were talking about, right? Like if internally you're curious, right? You want to know about yourself. You want to know, like, wait a second. Do I really like Schwarzenegger's book because I was a 128-pound kid in high school? Well, that's interesting. Like, what a cool thing to have stumbled on, right? You find something about yourself. The curiosity, the creativity, and the compassion, those things come back around to be this, like, this sacred connection with self. The idea that who you are and the experience of being you is worthy of the same level of study as the Torah or the sutras or the Bible, you know, like you as an endless internal entity are just as worthy of your own study, right? Like the inner experience of a human being is completely limitless, right? Like we never get to the end of our own internet, right? We can always find a new thing about ourselves or a new thought. And so the idea of the sacred self is just, what do you need so that you can be you can feel just as worthy of study as anything else? And anything that anything you want to study, you do it because you're curious. It taps into your creativity and it allows you to be patient and interested, which is a big part of compassion.
Speaking of compassion, self-compassion was the next thing on my list.
No, I love, you know, sometimes when you get to like the kind of, like you've called it like the mindfulness bubble, you know, like when all of a sudden like everything is fitting into mindfulness and so it seems to be getting bigger and bigger. It's always interesting to be all involved in something that is bubbling like that because you end up walking that tightrope of like self-compassion, and I'll kind of talk on how I view it in a sec, but like self-compassion is becoming more and more popular, is becoming, you know, Kristen Neff's book, Self-Compassion, is something that not only do I recommend, but usually when I recommend it, there's rereads and there's, you know, people kind of carrying it around. Like they know that there's something there. Yeah. They can't always touch it because self-compassion is so hard. We're so mean to ourselves. And so self-compassion, as it gets more popular, I think is going to grow and be like a big term. And I'm so excited about this popularity because I think it's so important. And then of course you carry the reservations of like, okay, but is there a bubble?
Yeah.
You know, is it going to become a massive term and then it's going to get a little watered down and, you know, it goes the way of other kind of popular topics.
I'm glad you remembered the bubble, my rants about the bubble. somebody was listening, but you really put you bring out the positive spin as well, which I wasn't dwelling on so much. So I appreciate that. And speaking of Kristen Neff, I will have forgotten the name of her husband, but her husband, I believe, is a filmmaker.
Really?
And they had an autistic child and little kid. They made a film about going to Tibet, I believe, on a journey to Tibet. Incredible film.
That sounds cool.
Looking for a shaman, somebody who could reach their son. It's a beautiful story, and there is a film too. So I think you would want to look for that, or I'll try to dig up the information if you want to follow up on it. But I 100%. Think you'd really like that story and deepening your relationship with the Neff adventure.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah. And here's something else that you wrote about that definitely comes from Buddhism. The spirit of no self.
Oh man, I do like the no self stuff. My early teaching in Buddhism formally was a lot of Zen Buddhism, and now what I've worked on for a while now is Tantric Buddhism. Just offshoots. All drinking out of the same well in their own ways. But where I fell into the concept of no self in terms of it really clicking was a lot of strength training stuff, which is why I was fortunate enough to be able to write on it. The idea of no self in Buddhism is one of these big layered, everybody talks about it, nobody understands it. Like emptiness is another one. Every Buddhist book you pick up will talk about emptiness. But then people will go, I get it, but I don't always get it. And that's the point, right? I mean, that's the point of a lot of spiritual teaching is it's supposed to be just enough that you never get a satisfied answer. Uh-huh. That you have to keep looking and keep looking, which is similar to the curiosity, the creativity, and the compassion. Like, if I don't understand this, but I'll keep talking about it, then I must be interested. And the idea of no self is oftentimes confused with this concept in Buddhism that you don't value anything or you don't connect to anything. And that's not a full representation of what it is, right? The idea of no self is, do you have enough compassion to see that there are certain things that you're calling self that are not as concrete and solid and constant as they feel? And so once you realize that those things are more fluid, then you're living in kind of the river of no self. You're in this stream of life rather than just stuck as kind of a cube there. And so the concept of no self in its kind of base psychological experience is, do I have the ability to say, here's who I feel like I am, or this feels very real, and in kind of like a dialectical sense, and maybe that's not as constant as I want it to be. So when I came through it in strength training, the answer that would come up a lot is, if I could lift a 300-pound Atlas stone one day and then struggle with it 2 weeks later, and I start all of a sudden having a crisis of identity out of it, like, it's probably because I'm clinging to a concrete view of self that is just not that accurate, right? We flow. We are fluid. That's the beauty of this experience of being a human.
Yeah. And in ego, it relates to ego as well, right? That's the next concept that I had on my list here. And so ego is very much about the self. And so no self would be pulling back from being so ego-identified, right? With,
yeah.
Hey, I'm supposed to be a 300-pound lifter now of stone, not 10 pounds less.
Right.
This doesn't fit with my ego doesn't like this.
And what's so fascinating is the amount of just like the severe subjectivity of self, where all of a sudden you can take something that would have been the most important thing to you a year ago, and you realize, man, it's not that big of a deal to me anymore, but I would have died on that hill a year ago. And that's how, you know, the self is just moving and the ego is trying to cling. It's trying to cling to a surface of something. And that doesn't make it bad. It makes it somewhat protective, right? The ego is just in there saying, hey, why don't we land here and stay here?
Yeah.
And then we know what comes next. We know what we need to do. We know how we need to make it work. But of course, life doesn't lend itself to that kind of static experience.
So how does this come into play for you as a therapist?
In a lot of ways, because I've worked with trauma for so long, it's a perfect thing to work on with trauma, because in terms of the protective piece, a person comes in and they are rigid for reasons that they deserve to be rigid, right? Like they're untrusting because they've been hurt. They are not connecting because they've been abandoned. They are dissociating because they've been threatened. And they're trying to create that somewhat constricted world that we now know is pretty associated with PTSD. You know, they're minimizing their experiences. They're minimizing their connections. And that's creating a rigid sense of experience that is denying curiosity and creativity and compassion. And it's doing that in the name of safety. So we don't want to look at that constriction and that narrowness, or even that what we would say is somewhat ego or self-based thing. We don't want to look at it as an enemy, right? It's a brilliant protector. Dissociation is a brilliant protector. I mean, what an unbelievable mechanism to have it at our unfortunate at times disposal. Yeah. And so we can take these rigid things and start just steadily becoming curious about, well, what are they protecting? And is there another way that we could do that same kind of protecting and expand your experience? You know, like all those things. And so we can take this ego and this rigid nature and this narrow nature and just start adding a little bit of, well, hey, man, I appreciate that you're protecting me, but is there another way we could do it? And it just, those little chunks, those little bite-sized pieces of curiosity where maybe somebody is like, oh, it is protecting me. Or, you know, and to really, we don't say anything negative, right? Like, I mentioned Gary Trosclair, who you've interviewed a couple of times. He says that he tells his clients that you can't talk really negatively about yourself in between sessions, because I don't have control over that. So I'm going to ask you not to do that. Huh. In my world, we do something similar, which is we ask questions along the lines of, like, we're not going to say good or bad. We're going to look at productive or unproductive.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to criticize. We're not going to criticize any part of you. You're the biggest, meanest, nastiest, push everybody away, self-destructive part of you. All he or she is doing is trying to do her job. And we're going to see if we can help him retire comfortably.
Yeah.
You know, no criticism.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. No criticism.
Yeah. Suffering is another topic here.
Yeah, I'm a Buddhist. That's like our favorite. So I talk about suffering a lot. There's an interesting story. The term that the Buddha, Siddhartha, the historical Buddha, used in his first noble truth that is widely translated as life is suffering, the term that he used was dukkha. D-U-K-K-H-A. And you'll see that in print, just a Sanskrit term. You know, you'll see books where they're talking about dukkha. The literal translation of dukkha is an axle that doesn't fit right on the wheel.
Hmm.
Right? So it gets translated as suffering, but it's really his way of saying, like, life is a grind, right? Like, it moves and it does its job, but it's not always going to fit just right. And when you can visualize that idea that, yes, life comes at you like an axle that doesn't fit right on the wheel, like you're still moving, like you're still getting up the steps in the morning, but your knee hurts. You know, like you're still wanting the same foods, but as we get older, they make our heart burn. You know, like life just doesn't fit right on the wheel. And so the whole process of therapy, of course, lends itself to that a lot. But in my world of strength training was exactly that way, where it's like, yeah, this is always going to be difficult. This is always going to be a little bit uncomfortable. But that uncomfortability still works in with a uncomfortable creativity or an uncomfortable, I wonder if there's another way I can do this because this is making my hamstring hurt. And that's all just an intimate relationship with dukkha, with suffering.
Uh-huh. Wow. You have a, I don't know if it's a logo for your business, Finding Your Light Source.
Yeah.
Is that the name of your private practice?
My practice is called Light Source. The logo is a lantern. And where that comes from, when I was first kind of opening up and doing my own thing and trying to see how I wanted to do it, the visual that came to mind was not something that illuminates a whole path, but just that thing that gives you enough light to see where you're going to go next.
Wow.
And so it was the image of like reading a book by candlelight, right? Where it's just enough to get the letters going and to read it and to enjoy it. But the rest of the world isn't so big and bright that you're distracted every couple of seconds from your book.
Fascinating. I like that.
And so it was the lantern. It was just, it illuminates the path, but it only illuminates the next couple of steps, and then you can reassess and keep going. It's not a floodlight that shows you everything at once. And so it brought us into the space of, well, what is, everyone has a light source, right? Find your, what is the thing that just lets you get to tomorrow? What is the thing that lets you get through a bad afternoon? And that's your light source. If that's a workout, that's a workout. If that's reading a spiritual text, that's reading a spiritual text. If that's calling your buddy Dr. Dave, it's calling your buddy Dr. Dave. But it's that's your light source, that little source of just enough illumination to get you to the next step.
That's fascinating. I'm really glad I asked you about that, and the way that you unpacked it is fascinating. Now, I know that you've done a lot of work in trauma, and we wanted to get some of that in here. You've worked with trauma, you've worked with sexual trauma. What do you want to say about that work? Is there something about your approach that is maybe unique that you could share?
I think that I always like to give credit in terms of my therapeutic background to whatever work I do is on the shoulder of giants. You know, like I don't think that there's anything, I don't think there's any wheels that I've reinvented in any way so much as kept the really big picture of the human experience always in the room. And so with trauma, there's, and I hate to make a dark topic something that has a bigger picture to it, but one of the things that trauma unlocked in the therapeutic world was it reintroduced us to a holistic approach. Trauma reintroduced the world to like, well, you can't just go tell the story, right? Because sometimes you go tell your story and it just makes you feel worse. So there's very careful approaches to narrative and storytelling. And then it was, well, it's stored in the body. So then we have to get like super knowledgeable clinicians to do EMDR and sensory motor work and somatic processing. And it's in the environment because we know that there's a big oppressive system and people like Rezma Menakem write books like My Grandmother's Hands on racial trauma and societal concerns. And so at Light Source, we're all very big on the idea of like, this is a big picture concern. Like trauma means you call in the cavalry. And the approach is how can there be that same kind of curiosity? You know, I, as I mentioned, have a, you know, psychodynamic awareness, Buddhist awareness, and different mindful approaches that I've worked with for a while. That allow me to do some great work and connective work and even transference and counter-transference work with people. But I don't do like body-based stuff. I make sure another trusted clinician can do EMDR or sensory motor work or somatic processing. And I think that maybe what I'm thankful to bring to the table is that I view therapy as such a beautiful calling that I want to call in the cavalry. I want to bring in every ounce of help an individual needs so that they know this is serious and it's going to be treated as such.
Well, that's great. Is there anything we haven't touched on here that you were hoping to get in, or anything else that you'd like to say as we wrap up?
I mean, Lord knows you can probably tell that I can wax poetic about the process for a while. So I think we've hit a lot of things that are so important to me. But I mean, to really formally say it, to wrap things up, like, I do want to say, like, I'm thankful to be here talking to you, because there's a big legacy of work that you've presented to a lot of us that are out here that is a real appreciation for the human experience, right? It's important for people to know that there are Jungians out here doing, like, unbelievable depth work, and there are ketamine-assisted people out here, and there's, you know, Betsy Beiler is doing substance use in an outpatient world and really, like, trying to give people a good experience, and that those are voices that not just inspire, but they give us that confidence that there's really good, meaningful work out here from people that just love hearing people and appreciating people. And, you know, you've been putting that out here for a long time. And I love therapy, and I've loved it for a long time. But it is deeply influenced by the conversations you've had with people.
Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for the opportunity to hang out with you here today. I hope it won't be the last. And I am so impressed by the synthesis and integration that you've been doing and will continue to do. So, Chaz, Frankie, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
No, I can't appreciate it enough, Dr. Dave. I'm thrilled.
Wow. You can probably tell that I'm very impressed by today's guest, Chaz Franke. He's the whole package. He's someone who really takes self-improvement seriously. Not only has he worked on physical strength training ever since boyhood, but he's applied that approach to every aspect of his being. He's not just an athlete, therapist, and spiritual seeker, which I already knew going into the interview. What I didn't know was how deeply he has invested himself in all of these. And what really impressed me during the interview is this guy's got a brain. He's really smart. He really studies hard and has an incredible memory. He doesn't just study hard, but he owns the material, incorporating it into his being. I'm not only flattered by his devotion to Shrink Wrap Radio and my earlier Wise Counsel podcast, but even more impressed by his memory of all that content. He was appropriately referencing names and concepts from people I interviewed years ago, all the way up to last week's interview. I couldn't do that. When I say he's the whole package, I mean wisdom, heart, spirit, soul, body, and brain. I love the way he talks and thinks about therapy. He's not in a rush. He's really into being fully present, giving the client lots of space, and the gift of his compassion and curiosity. I really loved his explanation of the lamp that is the logo for his private practice and the slogan that goes with it, finding your light source. As he explains it, the light is just bright enough to illuminate the path directly ahead, to see where to place your next footstep. To me, that communicates such care. I would feel very safe with such a therapist, such a gentle giant.
Hi, I'm Amy Fellman, longtime listener of Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio is like the best textbook I've ever owned. I've learned so much. I was even inspired to start my own podcast. I recently donated to Dr. Dave to show my gratitude for all the hard work and amazing content that he puts out there for us across the world. I hope that he's able to continue his quest in providing everything we need to know about psychology and just enough to make us dangerous. I encourage you all to do the same. I have to say, it feels really good. Thanks again, Dr. Dave. And for all you listeners out there just like me, bite the bullet and donate.
Thank you, Amy Fellman from Melbourne, for that strong endorsement. Again, I want to thank all of our regular donors out there. And remember, too, that one-time donations are also welcome on our site. At the same time, I know times are tight for many, and I appreciate all my listeners, whether they can help support this work financially or not. And with that, we'll wrap it up once again. Thanks again to Chaz Franke, MSW, LCSW, a practicing therapist for 15 years, working in prisons, forensic units, community mental health, and now private practice. He specializes in treating trauma and sexual trauma, and beyond all that, I thank him for all the personal insights he shared into his strength-building quest in therapeutic, physical, and spiritual facets of his life. Next week's return guest will be John Fredrickson, MSW, one of my favorites from past appearances, and we'll be discussing his newest book, Co-Creating Safety, Healing the Fragile Patient. So until then, please remember to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.